Hello and welcome to the Nordic Africa podcast, a series of conversations on current affairs in Africa. My name is Heba Habib and I am a communications officer here at the Nordic Africa Institute. Alas, this time, unlike every podcast, I am not joined by my very dear colleague Henrik Alfredsson, who's a little unwell, but hopefully he will join us for the next podcast. So African countries are increasingly recognizing the strategic importance of their mineral resources and are taking proactive steps to maximize their potential within the global supply chain. Many nations are implementing policies aimed at adding value to their mining outputs, particularly in high-demand sectors like lithium, cobalt, rare earth minerals, and precious stones. By investing in infrastructure, technology, and skills development, these countries are seeking to move beyond mere extraction and exportation of raw materials towards the creation of domestic processing and manufacturing capabilities. So, what are the challenges facing the continent when it comes to these ambitions? And can it achieve these goals sustainably? Here with us today to discuss these matters are Gracia Mukuzongi, postdoctoral fellow at the Center for African Studies at the University of Cape Town. Welcome, Gracia.
Oh, thank you.
Patricia Inonge Miwene, jewelry designer and entrepreneur in the Zambian gemstone industry. Very welcome, Patricia.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And our very own Patience Masseus, senior researcher here at the Nordic Africa Institute. Most welcome, Patience.
Ah, thanks, Heba. Great to be here.
Lovely to have you all. All right, so let's open up with the issue of value addition. In general, many African economies produce commodities or raw materials which are then exported and turned into capital, consumer, or intermediary group goods in other countries. This is not least true when it comes to the mining sector. So, unusually, we have a practitioner here with us in the podcast, Patricia. So I'll start with you. Let's go from the ground upwards, so to speak. So Patricia, you have hands-on experiences and knowledge of running a business with ambitions to move up value chains away from exporting just commodities or intermediary goods. Some 10 years ago, you started a workshop for cutting emeralds and gemstones in Ndola in the Zambian copper belt. Could you describe the barriers that you've had to encounter trying to move your business up to regional and global value supply chains or value chains rather?
There are several. I'll just touch on some of the main ones. I always say that whether Zambians like it or not, when it comes to natural resources, they are competing with the rest of the world for the same, you know, resources. The only difference is that the rest of the world buys the raw materials and then adds value to them and thereby, you know, triples the value of you know, turns them into finished products. And I've therefore able to make money off that. Whereas like in Zambia or in Africa, since the colonial times, we are still exporting raw materials. So one of the challenges that we have is that we have not evolved beyond supplying raw materials to the rest of the world. In terms of education, not much has been done to teach innovation or entrepreneurship, or even to teach young people in school skills, like, for example, value addition, gem cutting. Case in point, Zambia is the biggest a producer of emeralds in the world. On the other hand, we have a gem cutting school which has been running for 20 years, and all the graduate gem cutters are unemployed. And you have a government that has been talking about value addition and value addition, but there's no incentives in place actually to make it happen. So there's a massive disconnect between the private sector, the educational sector, and the mining sector. Okay. So the mining sector, and because there's this disconnect, it's really, it makes it very difficult actually to get things to market quickly.
I see. Very interesting. So turning to Patience now, the more into the abstract, well, not the abstract, but research perspective. So what do you see as the main challenge for the mining sector in Southern Africa in general when it comes to value adding?
Hi, Heba. Actually, Patricia mentioned two aspects already. One is the difficulty in shifting from being a raw commodity producer, but added on to that is skills. And I would say that currently, I think this is value addition, and it connected to that also industrialization and developing a manufacturing sector around raw commodities is a key area of interest for many African countries. But some of the kind of identified policy challenges kind of identified both at a high level but national governments are to do with infrastructure, and one of the key areas is energy, actually, to get things running and equipment and affordable and accessible energy, whether it's for gem cutting machinery or for refining and processing. It remains a significant issue and area. The other area Patricia touched on, which is to do with skills and education and making that education relevant. And I would say that on the back of protracted austerity policies within the region, several countries have fallen way, way, way behind in educational investments and would need to really ramp that up. But coupled to that is the kind of research and innovation and development tied into that educational component. And the third, also kind of identified both at a high level but also affecting entrepreneurs on the ground, is the cost of finance, affordable finance. This kind of perception of the continent as a producer of raw materials, and also because of the inequalities that shape this landscape, and in some context, some level of instability, not always justified actually for many countries which are relatively stable, effectively also places a risk premium, which makes it very difficult both for national governments to invest at an affordable level for energy infrastructure, but also within for education, but also for entrepreneurs on the ground. And I would say that those three areas are some of the key areas that are on the radar.
Okay, very, very, very good points. Gracin, do you have anything to add to that? In your work in Zimbabwe, what have been the main challenges for the mining sector, whether in lithium and gold, which I know are your areas of expertise?
Oh, thanks, Eva. I think, to be honest, it's just really an addition to what the colleagues have already said. I think we have a challenge in the region of a sort of colonial era trajectory of the export of unprocessed raw materials continuing to dominate our mining sector. So if you look, in fact, at the infrastructure, the mining infrastructure is very extroverted. It's designed to ship minerals out of the continent. And added to that is that if you see the average African country is deindustrializing at a time when we are supposed to massively catch up in terms of industrialization, hence manufacture goods and also create a value chain that is introverted towards Africa. Now, the challenge we have even within the new scramble for green minerals is that it remains extroverted. The infrastructure is extroverted. We don't have the technological and industrial infrastructure to beneficiate minerals. So we continue to export unprocessed minerals. But also added to that is what patients say is that we are energy insecure. The whole entire grid, especially in Southern Africa, is unstable because of climate change and other factors related to our inability to create infrastructure generating capacity at a time. Industrialization means we need to generate more energy, but we are not doing that. So our efforts towards industrialization cannot be realized in the absence of energy security. So that's a catch-22 situation we face.
Thank you very much for that. So on to a success story. So Botswana is often held up as Africa's success story when it comes to capitalizing on its natural resources. How has it managed to do so? And what are the lessons from this context that can be applied across the continent? Patricia, perhaps you can comment since you are in the gemstone industry.
I think the Botswana government has put policies in place that have supported beneficiation. And on top of that, in sub-Saharan Africa, Botswana is the only country where you have a Gemological Institute of America campus. So people in Botswana are able to study gemology, which is actually very important for the trade. jewelry skills, and they have also set up partnerships, diamond cutting. You know, there's quite a number of, I think, Indian diamond manufacturers who have set up shop in Botswana, which is not the case for Zambia, you know. So clearly, government policy is very important. And in the absence of that, you cannot have a success story like Botswana.
I see. I think I read something about that you yourself have tried to sort of cut this tie with India, where is a lot of where there's a lot of gemstones get refined, correct?
Yes.
How has that gone for you?
It's a nightmare. Oh. It's an absolute nightmare. Don't get me started.
Why so? If I dare to ask.
Well, I think there are several factors. So, okay, the thing is, yes, it's a challenge to cut emeralds in Zambia because they're very, you know, like if you want good quality emeralds, they're usually very, very difficult to get hold of. Most of the emeralds that we end up getting are from artisanal small scale miners, and their mining practices, you know, are not always the best, just put it like that. That being said, I think it's very important to remember that there are other gemstones apart from emeralds in Zambia, you know. So instead of focusing on the lack of access, for example, to emeralds, you know, we are cutting amethyst, we're cutting citrine, we're cutting tourmalines, we are cutting aquamarines, you know, we're trying to move forward and look at the other gemstones which are widely available. That being said, obviously, as I mentioned, we've had a gem cutting school for 20 years, but that education has not been updated for, I don't even know how to put this. There's a need to invest in education. Most of the times when I engage with people in the government, and it just shocks me that a lot of them don't know it, have enough knowledge about gemstones, you know, and about the market in general. It's very important to have in-house experts in key ministries that are working with gemstones. That could be the Ministry of Mines, you know. It's also very important that, for example, the Ministry of Commerce stays abreast with what is happening on the global market, you know, and gemstones are used in jewelry, you know. It's a $1 trillion industry. So the more we continue exporting these gemstones without adding any value, the more we lose out. We lose out in terms of market, but we also lose out in terms of skills, you know.
It's very heartening and disheartening simultaneously to hear that.
I call it, it's a beautiful nightmare. That's what I usually call it.
That's a very entrepreneurial way to see it. Okay, so this is an interesting trend and a very smooth transition, I think, to my next field of inquiry, which is artisanal versus industrial mining. So a strong characteristic of many African economies is that there is a huge informal sector, as you mentioned, Patricia. The mining sector is, of course, no exception. And many African countries have small-scale artisanal mining operating side-by-side with large-scale industrial mining. And sometimes they're together and sometimes they're apart, so to speak. And at other times, there are clashes between them. So to continue with you, Patricia, how much of the production of precious stones in Zambia today is large-scale and how much is small-scale, and how do the dynamics play out between them?
Okay. For Zambia is the biggest exporter of emeralds in the world. So for the emerald sector, the majority of it is large scale. You know, that's, I think, dominated by three emerald mines. And then you have amethyst, which is also large scale. The rest of the stones, I would probably say it's small scale. You know, citrine is artisanal mining, aquamarine artisanal mining, tourmalines artisanal mining. You know, so for emeralds and amethyst, the two mines, or rather, you know, Kajem and Kariba Minerals, Kajem was previously under ZCCM. It was under the Zambian parastatal. It's not anymore. I mean, they've got 75% and the Zambian government has got 25% shares. Those two I like scale mines. The rest are probably say small scale artisanal mining.
So, moving on to Zimbabwe and Gracia. So, Gracia, much of your past research has been regarding artisanal gold mining and more recently lithium. And so, what do you think are the main obstacles preventing the formalization of the sector? And how do political interests and corporate influence factor into this reluctance?
I think the main challenge is that most of the governments and jurisdictions across Africa tend to be biased towards large-scale corporate mining for obvious reasons. They naively think that huge mines creates employment, the source of resource rents, and also source of funding for infrastructure. Yet, when you look at what actually obtains on the ground across the region from South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, DRC, you see there's a lot of antagonism by local people and local communities towards large-scale mining because these mines are not creating the quality jobs. They are causing environmental degradation. They are not contributing to the fiscus in terms of resource rents. So that's where the conflict starts. When you see it, look at artisanal mining, for example, illegal or informal as might be, it does create employment. It does have an impact on local communities because the entry requirements for most artisanal mining activities across different mineral regimes are very low. It allows anyone to participate. Of course, there is always sometimes a concentration in terms of some syndicates doing better than others. But that's where the conflict starts. Conflict starts because artisanal mining should be seen in a lot of ways as a protest type of mining against corporate mining, because most of these people are not favored in terms of getting mining leases and licensing. So they end up operating on the margin of legality. So that's the problem. The problem is that the politicians favor large-scale mining for obvious reasons because they think it's a form of foreign direct investment. And most African governments are obsessed with foreign direct investment. But I think in the Zimbabwean case, it's interesting because politicians are now very much involved in artisanal mining activities across different mineral regimes, be it gold, be it chromite, be it lithium. So we are seeing a new trend where artisanal mining is becoming fashionable politically and economically. So that's a dynamic that we are observing in Zimbabwe. I also want to go back to that point of Botswana being called a success story. I think there's a desperation for success stories. I think there are things that Botswana has been doing, but I think if you look at industrialization across the region, Botswana is not an industrialized country. The infrastructure, the diamond cutting infrastructure in Botswana is very enclave. It's not that broadened in order because, for obvious reasons, the diamond market is not in Botswana. The cutting activities there is very extroverted for obvious reasons. There are good things they are doing there, but it's not a model that we would wish it's cascaded across the region because we don't see the returns.
I see. Would you say that in Botswana, it's only the elite that benefits from the economy as it is? Is there like
I would generally say that if you went across Botswana, for example, and asked people about diamonds, I mean, a lot of people are not benefiting from diamonds, neither do they know diamonds. So it's still enclave, and there is a level of what the government of Botswana has done is the ability to collect resource rents because of their partnership with Debswana, which is a good thing. And even let us remember there was a scuffle that just happened before a few months ago, when they were trying to get a better partnership that would benefit Botswana. That was a huge thing, which went through because the government was able to arm twist Anglo, whatever, De Beers, to get a better deal. So you can see there are still contestations at that level. If there is there are contestations at that level, what more grassroots people? So I think it is still an enclave. I think the best would have been a model where there's broader participation by ordinary Botswana people into this value chain. I think they are doing good things. They've set up some infrastructure, which is a positive thing, but it has to be broadened beyond an elite type of setup, which allows for De Beers to still play a dominant role in the extraction and marketing of the diamonds in overseas markets.
Is there a similar issue in Zambia, Patience?
Yeah, the dynamics in Zambia and across the region, as Gracian mentioned, are very similar. And Zambia is a case in point of a country that has prioritized large-scale mining and policies towards attracting foreign direct investment. And while there are plans effectively from a grassroots push to formalize artisanal mining, and there's still a struggle, I would say, from a policy perspective on how they see that integrated into a wider economy. And just to kind of give an example, you know, Zambia and countries such as the DR Congo, for example, are significant copper producers, right? And copper is key to electrification. And we are the Southern African development communities within a region where we're having an energy crisis, but all across the continent as well, you see kind of these wide urbanization trends. If one examines a lot of the policy, there is really not that much discussion around how these particular commodities build in and feed into, for example, electrification, how they feed in into a kind of building industry. With artisanal mining, for example, you have quite a lot of quarrying that builds into mining of river sand, that builds into a kind of construction sector. And those aspects of those kind of mining and kind of commodity production are not really seen as integrating within national and local economies, let alone regionally. And this speaks to something that both Patricia and Gracian have highlighted, and it's this kind of disconnect between research and knowledge that has been produced on mining within the region. There's more than 100-year history, for example, of industrial mining within the region, coupled with and since the implementation of structural adjustment policies in the 90s all across the region, artisanal mining has effectively grown as an alternative livelihood on the back of minimal formal employment. But that kind of knowledge and integration is not really feeding into policy processes. So, I mean, if one even had to be kind of, you know, a bit kind of provocative, right? So if one had to say that you have this really, really resource-rich region, what is really missing in this resource region is effectively the use of and seeing that its most valuable resource is the innovation and creativity of its largely youthful population.
This is and just to touch on what the patients mentioned, like Zambia has got two schools of mines and over the years has produced many mining professionals who are actually working in South Africa, the DRC, and in Botswana, some even as far as Australia. So there's really no shortage of skilled labor. What is in short supply is actually policies that work to benefit the people and keep these bright heads at home as well. You know, otherwise they wouldn't go out looking for greener pastures, you know.
So as I understand it, like the underlying message of everything you're saying is that reinvest in local communities. But if there is no foreign direct investment, what are the alternatives? Like, what do you think policymakers should do?
I think they should create an environment for entrepreneurs to create solutions, you know, local. What's wrong with homegrown solutions? You know, I mean, it's like all the solutions, we can't seem to continue believing that all the solutions to the development challenges that Africa has have to come from outside. I think it's important to create a good business environment for, case in point, we're talking about mining and gemstones. All these graduates from Copperbelt University School of Mines and, you know, from University of Zambia School of Mines, there are so many of them walking around the streets are unemployed. So I think the days of where you could go to university, graduate, and then you were guaranteed a nice cushy job with a government institution, those are long gone. So, but we are still producing a lot of graduates, you know, within these fields. And what I keep coming across oftentimes when I talk to people from this industry is that they're not really looked into the global commodity market. There's such a disconnect. Okay, let's say, for example, the last 15, 20 years, you know, the focus has been on responsible sourcing, you know. But you meet a mining engineer today and ask them what responsible sourcing, they'll tell you they don't know. You know. So you have this conversation going on here in the global north about responsible sourcing and what everyone is trying to do to be fair and ethical. But on the ground, you know, when you talk to people, it's like,
okay, so there's
no one cares.
I think that's a very important point that's mentioned there, because I think the idea of foreign direct investment is a very archaic idea, especially given the reconfiguration of global commodity markets. I think we have seen the African leadership going to FOCAC, the Forum for China-Africa Relations, Russia-Africa relations, America-Africa. It's because the thinking that influences the African leadership is that solutions to address some of our challenges are very much not in Africa. So I think that's kind of thinking that is also influencing institutions of higher learning. We are producing graduates monthly for foreign markets because we don't have the capacity to absorb those kinds of graduates. Good quality people like Patricia said, who are just some of them lying ideal. We need to put together the infrastructure so that our institutions of higher learning are also producing good quality graduates for local industry. But in the absence of industry, the question becomes, why are we training people? Or why are we not reconfiguring our education system to meet the demands? Again, our quandary is that we don't have investments. And I think the absence of FDI is just talks to the reconfiguration of capitalism, you know. There's not that much money that is coming to permanently invest in African countries because most of the capital is speculative. No one wants to bring a billion into the African context, into an African country. The patients did highlight there is also that issue of the risk factors, perceived risk factors. There's also issues of African governments. Some of them are under sanctions, like Zimbabwe more recently, and South Africa seem to be also facing sanctions. So there is a lot of other challenges that African countries are facing, which deters the kinds of long-term investments in form of FDI. And our leadership seem not to be aware that no one actually wants their money to stay in Africa. If you look as well, every African country is undergoing a form of currency instability.
Yes.
Every African country.
Yes.
There is no African country with current stability. And it is a reflection of the way things are. So most of these people with money, they will think, if I invest in Zambia, I'm not sure about where the kwacha is going. It's unstable. I might not be able to recoup my profits and so forth. So we are a victim of a bigger system, which there is supposed to be a way of us decoupling ourselves and being more introverted so that we caution ourselves against some of the global shocks, some of which are deliberate.
Yes. So internal resilience, in a way, is
yes.
The...
yes, internal resilience.
Yes.
Because I just wanted to add quickly that
yes,
if you look
please.
At major infrastructures, most of our infrastructures across the region are not interconnected to the region because we are doing very little trade with each other. So a lot of the infrastructure is towards the sea because we want to ship things. If you wanted to go to some of these countries by road, the roads are not very good. Yet these roads, the distances are pretty closed. So that infrastructure that connects the region is what is needed. We must be able to find infrastructure in Zambia, Zimbabwe, DRC, South Africa. That infrastructure is dilapidated. It needs to be reinvigorated to promote integration. At policy level, we have the right commercial policies, Africa Free Trade, whatever, there is the policy infrastructure. But in practice, very little is happening to integrate the continent. Even human mobility is hardly very impossible for most African people to travel to other African countries.
Yes.
And that's a fundamental problem, which is about promoting regional trade. and promoting local beneficiation. For example, Zimbabwe produces platinum group metals, which are shipped to South Africa for processing. Why can't we see that happening between Zambia and the DRC, between Zimbabwe and South Africa, so that we can beneficiate minerals in the region and pool together resources? But instead, we are seeing an outbreak of xenophobia across the region rather than integration. So these are the challenges that at a leadership level must be resolved.
Can I just add on to what that?
Yes, please.
All the infrastructure which was needed to get raw materials out of Africa is there. You know, from colonial times, that infrastructure which was built in order to facilitate the export of raw materials from the continent is there. That's intact. You know, times have changed. I mean, now there's talk of the Africa Free Trade Agreement. That requires different infrastructure.
Yes.
So again, we are still struggling, you know, with this colonial hangover. We're trying to move forward, but with the old systems in place.
Yes.
I would say, I mean, I think that there's a bit of a shift. And I think COVID-19, to some extent with the disruption in global supply chains, catalyzed, I would say, a little bit more thinking about how to then begin to shift policies towards greater integration. I mean, I agree that there's not enough that's been done and not at the pace that's required, but there is the beginnings, even amidst the context, I would say, of growing xenophobia and nationalism that forms part of this kind of wider global trend. There are some efforts and pushed by Africa policymakers and also argued for by researchers to cooperate more in these regional bilateral agreements that intersect within the region. You know, some of what Gracian mentioned towards, you know, looking at processing for specific minerals within the region. There's a beginning of a conversation of that, which I would say 10 years ago, you'd barely find. And so my optimistic side is, you know, we're moving at least rhetorically in the right direction. My pessimistic side is that the hard infrastructure that's being developed is still geared towards extroversion. And I struggle to see that, you know, that the current kind of government focus towards, you know, and Gracian mentioned all these kind of forum attendance.
Yes.
Is that there's a huge risk of Africa policymakers being hugely distracted and effectively losing a little bit of a sight of what actually the population and grassroots and also policymakers are pushing for on the ground towards trading more together, towards making resources work to build up African infrastructure and a manufacturing sector to kind of arise out of this kind of commodities. And to also cooperate a lot more on knowledge. I mean, as it is right now, I mean, it's quite shocking if one looks at the Southern African development communities that South Africa, I think, is the only country within the region that is spending any level of money on research and development. The rest of the region is not. And actually underspending. And if collectively they have to kind of work and integrate together, they need to be mobilizing resources internally and putting something on the table and not looking out all the time. Or if they do look out, I would argue that they should be locking in long-term partnerships in the areas that they see interlinking within their economies. But I'm optimistic that they might. I'm pessimistic that
there's too many other agendas at play, maybe?
Too many other agendas, too many other interests.
Yes.
And I'm not so sure that Africa's policymakers are navigating the external factors and the domestic demands and regional demands very well.
We can say that again. Anyway, I like this mix of optimism and pessimism. I oscillate between the two myself. I think this whole podcast has highlighted the importance of action versus rhetoric. I think that's the bottom line. And on that note, thank you, Patience, Patricia, and Gracian for your time. And thank you to our listeners who have made it thus far into this podcast. And if you want to listen to other podcasts, of course, you can listen on our website, nai.uu.se. or on wherever you listen to podcasts to. And thank you very much.